Asta gasped. Bright Lord Vadam? You little whore! Have you forgotten how he locked away your father?
Weema, Bright Lord Sterling intoned, it seems I have gravely misjudged your attentions. In this I find myself deposited deep within an embarrassment of folly. I shall be away, to the shattered plains, and you shall not again suffer the torment of my presence.
He bowed a true gentleman's bow, possessed of all proper refinement and deference. It was a supplication beyond what even a monarch could rightly demand, and in it Weema ascertained the true nature of Bright Lord Sterling's regard. Simple, yet passionate, respectful indeed. It lent great context to his earlier advance, which now appeared all at once to be a righteous division in otherwise sure armor, a window of vulnerability rather than a model of avarice. As he lifted the door's latch to forever make his exodus from her life, Weema surged with unrivaled shame and longing, twisted together not unlike two threads winding in a loom to construct a grand tapestry of desire. "Wait!" Weema cried. "Dear Sterling, wait upon my words!"
"Storm's right, you'd better wait, Sterling!"
Elista leaned closer to the book, flipping the page. Decorum seemed a vain thing to her now, lost upon the sea that was her need to feel Sterling's touch. She rushed to him, and upon his arm pressed her ensleeved hand, which she then lifted to caress his sturdy jaw. It was so warm out here in the forest, practically sweltering. Elista put her hand to her lips, reading with wide eyes, trembling. "Would that the window through that statuesque armor could still be located, and that a similar wound within herself might be found, to press against his own and offer passage deep within her soul. If only..."
"Elista?" a voice asked.
"Yip!" she said, bolting upright, snapping the book closed, and spun toward the sound. Oh, Ardent Irv." The young Siln Ardent was tall, gangly, and obnoxiously loud at times, except apparently when sneaking up on colleagues in the forest.
"What was that you were studying?" he asked.
"Important works," Elista said, then sat on the book. "Nothing to mind yourself with. What is it you want?" He looked down at her satchel.
"You were the last one to check out the transcriptions from Benthel's collected Dawn Chant? The old versions? I just wanted to check on your progress."
"Dawn Chant. Right."
They'd been working on that before this storm came and everyone got distracted. Old Navani Kolin in Alethkar had somehow cracked the Dawn Chant. Her story about visions was nonsense. The Kolin family was known for opaque politics. But her key was authentic, and had let them slowly work through the old texts. Elista started digging in her satchel. She came up with three musty codices and a sheaf of papers, the latter being the work she'd done so far. Annoyingly, Irv settled on the ground beside her stump, taking the papers as she offered them. He laid his satchel across his lap and began reading.
"Incredible," he said a few moments later. "You've made more progress than I have."
"Everyone else is too busy worrying about that storm."
"Well, it is threatening to wipe out civilization."
"An overreaction. Everyone always overreacts to every little gust of wind."
He flipped through her pages. "What's this section? Why take such care for where each text was found? Fixin concluded that these Dawn Chant books had all spread from a central location, and so there's nothing to learn by where they ended up."
"Fixin was a bootlicker, not a scholar," Elista said. "Look, there's easy proof here that the same writing system was once used all across Roshar. I have references in Makabakam, Selatales, Alethala. Not a diaspora of texts, but real evidence they wrote naturally in the Dawn Chant.
You suppose they all spoke the same language?
Hardly.
But Yasna Kolin's relic and monument?
Doesn't claim everyone spoke the same language, only that they wrote it. It's foolish to assume that everyone used the same language across hundreds of years and dozens of nations. It makes more sense that there was a codified written language, the language of scholarship, just like you'll find many undertexts written in Alethi now.
Ah, he said. And then a desolation hit.
Ballista nodded, showing him a later page in her sheaf of notes. This in-between weird language is where people started using the Dawn Chant script to phonetically transcribe their language. It didn't work so well. She flipped two more pages. In this scrap, we have one of the earliest emergences of the proto-Thalo-Voran glyphic radicals, and here's one showing a more intermediate Thalan form. We've always wondered what happened to the Dawn Chant. How could people forget how to read their own language? Well, it seems clear now. By the point this happened, the language had been moribund for millennia. They weren't speaking it and hadn't been for generations.
Brilliant, Irv said.
He wasn't so bad. For a Siln.
I've been translating what I can but got stuck on the Kovad fragment. If what you've been doing here is correct, it might be because Kovad isn't true Dawn Chant, but a phonetic transcription of another ancient language.
He glanced to the side, then cocked his head. Was he looking at her? Oh, no. It was just the book, which she was still sitting on.
An accountability of virtue, he grunted. Good book.
You've read it?
I have a fondness for Alethi epics, he said absently, flipping through her pages. She really should have picked Vadam, though. Sterling was a flatterer and a cadger.
Sterling is a noble and upright officer, she narrowed her eyes. And you are just trying to get a rise out of me, Ardent Irv.
Maybe.
He flipped through her pages, studying a diagram she'd made of various Dawn Chant grammars.
I have a copy of the sequel.
There's a sequel?
About her sister.
The mousy one?
She is elevated to courtly attention and has to choose between a strapping naval officer, a Thalan banker, and the king's wit.
Wait. There are three different men this time?
Sequels always have to be bigger, he said,
then offered her the stack of pages back.
I'll lend it to you.
Oh, you will you? And what is the cost for this magnanimous gesture, Bright Lord Irv?
Your help, translating a stubborn section of Dawn Chant. A particular patron of mine has a strict deadline upon its delivery.
Interlude 3. The Rhythm of the Lost. Venli attuned the rhythm of craving as she climbed down into the chasm. This wondrous new form, storm form, gave her hands a powerful grip, allowing her to hang hundreds of feet in the air, yet never fear that she would fall. The chitin plating under her skin was far less bulky than that of the old war form, but at the same time nearly as effective. During the summoning of the Everstorm, a human soldier had struck her directly across the face. His spear had cut her cheek and across the bridge of her nose, but the mask of chitin armor underneath had deflected the weapon. She continued to climb down the wall of stone, followed by Demid, her once mate, and a group of her loyal friends. In her mind, she attuned the rhythm of command, a similar yet more powerful version of the rhythm of appreciation. Every one of her people could hear the rhythms, beats with some tones attached, yet she no longer heard the old common ones, only these new superior rhythms. Beneath her, the chasm opened, where water from high storms had carved a bulge. She eventually reached the bottom, and the others dropped around her, each landing with a thumping crunch. Ulim moved down the stone wall. The spren usually took the form of rolling lightning, moving across surfaces. At the bottom, he formed from lightning into a human shape with odd eyes. Ulim settled on a patch of broken branches, arms folded, his long hair rippling in an unseen wind. She wasn't certain why a Spren sent by Odium himself would look human.
"Around here, somewhere," Ulim said, pointing. "Spread out and search."
Venli set her jaw, humming to the rhythm of fury. Lines of power rippled up her arms. "Why should I continue to obey your orders, Spren? You should obey me." The Spren ignored her, which further stoked her anger. Demid, however, placed his hand on her shoulder and squeezed, humming to the rhythm of satisfaction.
"Come, look with me this way."
She curtailed her humming and turned south, joining Demid, picking her way through debris. Krem buildup had smoothed the floor of the chasm, but the storm had left a great deal of refuse. She attuned the rhythm of craving, a quick, violent rhythm.
"I should be in charge, Demid, not that Spren."
"You are in charge."
"Then why haven't we been told anything? Our gods have returned, yet we've barely seen them. We sacrificed greatly for these forms, and to create the glorious true storm. We lost how many?"
Sometimes she thought about that, in strange moments when the new rhythms seemed to retreat. All of her work, meeting with Ulim in secret, guiding her people towards storm form. It had been about saving her people, hadn't it? Yet of the tens of thousands of listeners who had fought to summon the storm, only a fraction remained. Demid and she had been scholars, yet even scholars had gone to battle. She felt at the wound on her face.
"Our sacrifice was worthwhile," Demid told her to the rhythm of derision. "Yes, we have lost many, but humans sought our extinction. At least this way some of our people survived, and now we have great power."
He was right. And if she was being honest, a form of power was what she had always wanted. And she'd achieved one, capturing a Spren in the storm within herself. That hadn't been one of Ulim's species, of course. Lesser Spren were used for changing forms. She could occasionally feel the pulsing deep within of the one she'd bonded. In any case, this transformation had given her great power. The good of her people had always been secondary to Venli. Now was a late time to be having a bout of conscience. She resumed humming to craving. Demid smiled and gripped her shoulder again. They'd shared something once, during their days in mate form. Those silly, distracting passions were not ones they currently felt, nor were they something that any sane listener would desire. But the memories of them did create a bond. They picked through the refuse, passing several fresh human corpses, smashed into a cleft in the rock. Good to see those. Good to remember that her people had killed many, despite their losses.
"Venli," Demid said. "Look."
He scrambled over a log from a large wooden bridge that was wedged in the center of the chasm. She followed, pleased by her strength. She would probably always remember Demid as the gangly scholar he had been before this change, but she doubted either of them would ever willingly return. Forms of power were simply too intoxicating. Once across the log, she could see what Demid had spotted. A figure slumped by the wall of the chasm, helmeted head bowed. A shard blade, shaped like frozen flames, rose from the ground beside her, rammed into the stone floor.
"Eshanai, finally!"
Venli leaped from the top of the log, landing near Demid. Eshanai looked exhausted. In fact, she wasn't moving.
"Eshanai,"
Venli said, kneeling beside her sister.
"Are you well? Eshanai?"
She gripped the plated figure by the shoulders and lightly shook it. The head rolled on its neck, limp. Venli felt cold. Demid solemnly lifted Eshanai's faceplate, revealing dead eyes set in an ashen face.
"Eshanai, no."
"Ah," Ulim's voice said. "Excellent.
The Spren approached across the stone wall like crackling lightning moving through the stone.
Demid, your hand.
Demid obediently raised his hand, palm up, and Ulim shot across from the wall to the hand, then formed into his human shape, standing on the perch.
Plate looks completely drained. Broken along the back, I see. Well, it's said to regrow on its own, even now that it is separated from its master from so long ago.
The plate, Venli said softly, numb.
You wanted the plate.
Well, the blade, too, of course. Why else would we be hunting a corpse? You... Oh, you thought she was alive?
When you said we needed to find my sister, Venli said. I thought...
Yes, looks like she drowned in the storm's floodwaters,
Ulim said, making a sound like a tongue clicking.
Rammed the sword into the stone, held onto it to stay in place, but couldn't breathe.
Venli attuned the rhythm of the lost. It was one of the old inferior rhythms. She hadn't been able to find those since transforming, and she had no idea how she happened upon this one. The mournful, solemn tone felt distant to her.
Eshonai,
she whispered, and nudged the corpse again. Demid gasped. Touching the bodies of the fallen was taboo. The old songs spoke of days when humans had hacked apart listener corpses, searching for gem hearts. Leave the dead to peace instead. It was their way. Venli stared into Eshonai's dead eyes.
You are the voice of reason, Venli thought. You were the one who argued with me. You were supposed to keep me grounded. What do I do without you?
Well, let's get that plate off, kids, Ulim said.
Show respect, Venli snapped.
Respect for what? It's for the best that this one died.
For the best? Venli said. For the best?
She stood, confronting the little Spren on Demid's outstretched palm.
That is my sister. She is one of our greatest warriors, an inspiration, and a martyr.
Ulim rolled his head in an exaggerated way, as if perturbed and bored by the chastisement.
How dare he? He was merely a Spren. He was to be her servant. Your sister, Ulim said, didn't undergo the transformation properly. She resisted, and we'd have eventually lost her. She was never dedicated to our cause.
Venli attuned the rhythm of fury, speaking in a loud, punctuating sequence.
You will not say such things. You are Spren. You are to serve.
And I do.
Then you must obey me.
You?
Ulim laughed.
Child, how long have you been fighting your little war against the humans? 3-4 years?
6 years, Spren, Demid said. 6 long, bloody years.
Well, do you want to guess how long we've been fighting this war?
Ulim asked.
Go ahead. Guess. I'm waiting.
Venli seethed. It doesn't matter.
Oh, but it does,
Ulim said, his red figure electrifying.
Do you know how to lead armies, Venli? True armies? Supply troops across a battlefront that spans hundreds of miles? Do you have memories and experiences that span eons?
She glared at him.
Our leaders, Ulim said, know exactly what they're doing. Them I obey. But I am the one who escaped. The Spren of redemption. I don't have to listen to you.
I will be a queen, Venli said to spite.
If you survive? Maybe. But your sister? She and the others sent that assassin to kill the human king specifically to keep us from returning. Your people are traitors, though your personal efforts do you justice, Venli. You may be blessed further, if you are wise. Regardless, Get that armor off your sister, shed your tears, and get ready to climb back up. These plateaus are crawling with men who stink of honor. We must be away and see what your ancestors need us to do.
Our ancestors? Demid said. What do the dead have to do with this?
Everything, Ulim replied, seeing as they're the ones in charge. Armor. Now!
He zipped to the wall as a tiny streak of lightning, then moved off. Venli attuned derision at the way she'd been treated, then, defying taboos, helped Demid remove the shard plate. Ulim returned with the others and ordered them to gather up the armor. They hiked off, leaving Venli to bring the blade. She lifted it from the stone, then lingered, regarding her sister's corpse, which lay there in only padded underclothing. Venli felt something stir inside her. Again, distantly, she was able to hear the rhythm of the lost. Mournful, slow, with separated beats.
"Aye," Venli said. "Finally, I don't have to listen to you call me a fool. I don't have to worry about you getting in the way. I can do what I want."
That terrified her. She turned to go, but paused as she saw something. What was that small spren that had crept out from beneath Eshonai's corpse? It looked like a small ball of white fire. It gave off little rings of light and trailed a streak behind it, like a comet.
"What are you?" Venli demanded to spite. "Shoo!"
She hiked off, leaving her sister's corpse there at the bottom of the chasm, stripped and alone. Food for either a chasm fiend or a storm. Shallan's Sketchbook, Urethiru.
"The city is incredibly huge. A chasm fiend's back would not reach the fourth floor."
Part 2. New Beginnings Sing. Shallan, Yasna, Dalinar, Bridge 4. 33. A Lecture. "Dearest Sephandrius, I received your communication, of course."
Yasna was alive. Yasna Kolin was alive!
Shallan was supposed to be recovering from her ordeal, never mind that the bridgeman had handled the fighting. All she'd done was grope an eldritch spren. Still, she spent the next day holed up in her room, sketching and thinking. Yasna's return sparked something in her. Shallan had once been more analytical in her drawing, including notes and explanations with the sketches. Lately, she'd only been doing pages and pages of twisted images. Well, she'd been trained as a scholar, hadn't she? She shouldn't just draw. She should analyze, extrapolate, speculate. So she addressed herself to fully recording her experiences with the unmade. Adolin and Polona visited her separately, and even Dalinar came to check on her, while Navani clicked her tongue and asked after her health. Shallan endured their company, then eagerly returned to her drawing. There were so many questions. Why exactly had she been able to drive the thing away? What was the meaning of its creations? Hanging over her research, however, was a single daunting fact. Yasna was alive. Storms. Yasna was alive. That changed everything. Eventually, Shallan couldn't remain locked up any longer. Though Navani mentioned Yasna was planning to visit her later in the evening, Shallan washed and dressed, then threw her satchel over her shoulder and went searching for the woman. She had to know how Yasna had survived. In fact, as Shallan stalked the hallways of Urethiru, she found herself increasingly perturbed. Yasna claimed to always look at things from a logical perspective, but she had a flair for the dramatic to rival any storyteller. Shallan well remembered that night in Carbranth, when Yasna had lured thieves in, then dealt with them in stunning and brutal fashion.
Yasna didn't want to merely prove her points. She wanted to drive them right into your skull with a flourish and a pithy epigram. Why hadn't she written via Spanreed to let everyone know she had survived? Storms, where had she been all this time? A few inquiries led Shallan back to the pit with its spiraling stairs. Guards in sharp Kolin blue confirmed that Yasna was below, so Shallan started trudging down those steps again, and was surprised to find that she felt no anxiety at the descent. In fact, the oppressive feelings she'd felt since they'd arrived at the tower seemed to have evaporated. No more fear, no more formless sense of wrongness. The thing she'd chased away had been its cause. Somehow its aura had pervaded the entire tower. At the base of the stairs, she found more soldiers. Dalinar obviously wanted this place well guarded. She certainly couldn't complain about that. These let her pass without incident, save a bow and a murmur of brightness radiant. She strode down the muraled hallway, the sphere lanterns set along the base of the walls making it pleasingly bright. Once she'd passed the empty library rooms to either side, she heard voices drifting toward her from ahead. She stepped up into the room where she'd faced the Midnight Mother, and got her first good look at the place when it wasn't covered in writhing darkness. The crystal pillar at the center really was something incredible. It wasn't a single gemstone, but a myriad of them fused together. Emerald, ruby, topaz, sapphire. All 10 varieties seemed to have been melted into a single thick pillar, 20 feet tall. Storms! What would it look like if all those gems were somehow infused, rather than done as they were at the moment? A large group of guards stood at a barricade near the other side of the room, looking down into the tunnel where the unmade had vanished. Yasna rounded the giant pillar, free hand resting on the crystal. The princess wore red, lips painted to match, hair up and run through with sword-like hair spikes, with rubies on the pommels. Storms! She was perfect. A curvaceous figure, tan alethi skin, light violet eyes, and not a hint of aberrant color to her jet-black hair. Making Yasna Kolin as beautiful as she was brilliant was one of the most unfair things the Almighty had ever done. Shallan hesitated in the doorway, feeling much as she had upon seeing Yasna for the first time in Carbranth. Insecure, overwhelmed, and, if she was honest, incredibly envious. Whatever ordeals Yasna had been through, she looked no worse for wear. That was remarkable, considering that the last time Shallan had seen Yasna, the woman had been lying unconscious on the floor while a man rammed a knife through her chest. "My mother," Yasna said, hand still on the pillar, not looking toward Shallan, "thinks this must be some kind of incredibly intricate fabrial. A logical assumption. We've always believed that the ancients had access to great and wonderful technology. How else do you explain shard blades and shard plate?" "Brightness?" Shallan said. "But shard blades aren't fabrials. They're spren, transformed by the bond. As are fabrials, after a manner of speaking," Yasna said. "You do know how they're made, don't you?" "Only vaguely," Shallan said. "This was how their reunion went? A lecture?" "Fitting." "You capture a spren," Yasna said, "and imprison it inside a gemstone crafted for the purpose. Artifabrians have found that specific stimuli will provoke certain responses in the spren. For example, flame spren give off heat, and by pressing metal against a ruby with a flame spren trapped inside, you can increase or decrease that heat." "That's incredible. Horrible," Shallan said. She'd known some of this, but to contemplate it directly appalled her. "Brightness? We're imprisoning spren? No worse than hitching a wagon to a chull." "Sure, if in order to get a chull to pull a wagon you first had to lock it in a box forever." Pattern hummed softly from her skirts in agreement. Yasna just cocked an eyebrow. There are spren and there are spren, child. She rested her fingers on the pillar again. Do a sketch of this for me. Be certain to get the proportions and colors right, if you please. The careless presumption of the command hit Shallan like a slap in the face. What was she? Some servant? To be given orders? Yes, a part of her affirmed. That's exactly what you are. You're Yasna's ward. The request wasn't at all unusual in that light. But compared to how she had grown accustomed to being treated, it was... Well, it wasn't worth taking offense at, and she should accept that. Storms! When had she grown so touchy? She took out her sketch pad and got to work. I was heartened to hear that you had made it here on your own, Yasna said. I apologize for what happened on Wind's Pleasure. My lack of foresight caused the deaths of many and doubtless hardship for you, Shallan. Please accept my regret. Shallan shrugged, sketching. You've done very well, Yasna continued. Imagine my amazement when I reached the Shattered Plains, only to discover that the war camp had already relocated to this tower. What you have accomplished is brilliant, child. We will need to speak further, however, about the group that again tried to assassinate me. The Ghost Bloods will almost certainly start targeting you, now that you've begun progressing toward your final ideals. You're sure it was the Ghost Bloods that attacked the ship? Of course I am. She glanced at Shallan, lips turning down. Are you certain you're well enough to be about, child? You seem uncharacteristically reserved. I'm fine. You're displeased because of the secrets I kept. We all need secrets, Brightness. I know this more than anyone. But it would have been nice if you had let us know you were alive. Here I was assuming I could handle things on my own. Assuming I'd have to handle things on my own. But all that time, you were on your way back to toss everything into the air again. I only had the opportunity upon reaching the war camps, Yasna said. And there decided that I couldn't risk it. I was tired and unprotected. If the Ghost Bloods wished to finish me off, they could have done so at their leisure. I determined that a few more days of everyone believing I was dead would not greatly increase their distress. But how did you even survive in the first place? Child, I'm an Else Caller. Of course. An Else Caller, Brightness. A thing you never explained. A word which no one but the most dedicated scholar of the esoteric would recognize. That explains it perfectly. Yasna smiled for some reason. All Radiants have an attachment to Shadesmar, Yasna said. Our spren originate there, and our bond ties us to them. But my order has special control over moving between realms. I was able to shift to Shadesmar to escape my would-be assassins. And that helped? With the knife in your storming chest? No, Yasna said. But surely by now you've learned the value of a little stormlight when it comes to bodily wounds. Of course she had, and she could probably have guessed all of this. But for some reason she didn't want to accept that. She wanted to remain annoyed at Yasna. My true difficulty was not escaping, but returning, Yasna said. My powers make it easy to transfer to Shadesmar, but getting back to this realm is no small feat. I had to find a transfer point, a place where Shadesmar and our realm touch, which is far, far more difficult than one might assume. It's like going downhill one way, but uphill to get back. Well, perhaps her return would take some pressure off Shallan. Yasna could be Brightness Radiant, and Shallan could be, well, whatever she was. We will need to converse further, Yasna said. I would hear the exact story from your perspective of the discovery of Urethiru, and I assume you have sketches of the transformed parchment? That will tell us much. I believe I once disparaged the usefulness of your artistic skill. I now find reason to call myself foolish for that presumption.
It's fine, Brightness, Shallan said with a sigh, still sketching the pillar.
I can get you those things, and there is a lot to talk about.
But how much of it would she be able to say?
How would Jasnah react, for instance, to finding that Shallan had been dealing with the Ghost Bloods?
It's not like you're really a part of their organization, Shallan thought to herself. If anything, you're using them for information. Jasnah might find that admirable.
Shallan still wasn't eager to broach the topic.
I feel lost, Jasnah said.
Shallan looked up from her sketchbook to find the woman regarding the pillar again, speaking softly, as if to herself.
For years I was at the very forefront of all this, Jasnah said. One short stumble and I find myself scrambling to stay afloat. These visions that my uncle is having, the refounding of the Radiance in my absence. That Wind Runner. What do you think of him, Shallan?
I find him much as I imagined his order, but I have only met him once.
It has all come so quickly. After years of struggling in the shadows, everything coming to light, and despite my years of study, I understand so very little.
Shallan continued her sketch.
It was nice to be reminded that for all their differences, there were occasional things that she and Jasnah shared. She just wished that ignorance weren't at the top of the list.
34. Resistance. I noticed its arrival immediately, just as I noticed your many intrusions into my land.
It is time, the Stormfather said.
All went dark around Dalinar, and he entered a place between his world and the visions, a place with a black sky and an infinite floor of bone-white rock. Shapes made of smoke seeped through the stone ground, then rose around him, dissipating. Common things, a chair, a vase, a rock bud. Sometimes people.
I have her.
The Stonefather's voice shook this place, eternal and vast.
The Thalen Queen. My storm hits her city now.
Good, Dalinar said. Please give her the vision. Finn was to see the vision with the Knights Radiant falling from the sky, come to deliver a small village from a strange and monstrous force. Dalinar wanted her to see the Knights Radiant firsthand, as they had once been. Righteous, protecting.
Where shall I put her? The Stormfather asked.
The same place you put me my first time, Dalinar said. In the home, with the family.
And you?
I'll observe, then talk to her after.
You must be part of events, the Stormfather said, sounding stubborn. You must take the role of someone. This is how it works.
Fine. Pick someone. But if possible, make Fenn see me as myself, and let me see her. He felt at the side sword he wore at his belt. And can you let me keep this? I'd rather not have to fight with a poker again. The Stormfather rumbled in annoyance, but did not object. The place of endless white stone faded.
What was that place? Dalinar asked. It is no place.
But everything else in these visions is real, Dalinar said. So why is it that...
It is no place, the Stormfather insisted firmly.
Dalinar fell silent, letting himself be taken by the vision.
I imagined it, the Stormfather said more softly, as if he were admitting something embarrassing. All things have a soul. A vase, a wall, a chair. And when a vase is broken, it might die in the physical realm, but for a time its soul remembers what it was. So all things die twice. Its final death is when men forget it was of Oz, and think only of the pieces. I imagine the vase floating away then, its form dissolving into the nothingness.
Dalinar had never heard anything so philosophical from the Stormfather. He hadn't imagined it was possible that a Spren, even a mighty one of the High Storms, could dream in such a way. Dalinar found himself hurtling through the air. Flailing his arms, he shouted in panic. First Moon's violet light bathed the ground far below. His stomach lurched, and his clothes flapped in the wind. He continued yelling until he realized that he wasn't actually getting closer to the ground. He wasn't falling. He was flying. The air was rushing against the top of his head, not his face. Indeed, now he saw that his body was glowing, stormlight streaming off him. He didn't feel like he was holding it, though. No raging inside his veins, no urge to action. He shielded his face from the wind and looked forward. A radiant flew ahead, resplendent in blue armor that glowed, the light brightest at the edges and in the grooves. The man was looking back at Dalinar, doubtless because of his cries. Dalinar saluted him to indicate he was all right. The armored man nodded, looking forward again.
"He's a Windrunner," Dalinar thought, piecing it together. "I've taken the place of his companion, a female Radiant."
He'd seen these two in the vision before. They were flying to save the village. Dalinar wasn't moving under his own power. The Windrunner had lashed the female Radiant into the sky, as Zeth had done to Dalinar during the Battle of Narak. It was still difficult to accept that he wasn't falling, and a sinking feeling persisted in the pit of his stomach. He tried to focus on other things. He was wearing an unfamiliar brown uniform, though he was glad to note that he had his side sword as requested. But why didn't he have on shard plate? In the vision, the woman had worn a set that glowed amber. Was this the result of the Stormfather trying to make him look like himself to Fen? Dalinar still didn't know why radiant plate glowed, while modern shard plate did not. Was the ancient plate living somehow? Like radiant blades lived? Perhaps he could find out from that radiant ahead. He had to ask his questions carefully, however. Everyone would see Dalinar as the radiant he had replaced, and if his questions were uncharacteristic, that tended only to confuse people, rather than get him answers.
"How far away are we?" Dalinar asked.
The sound was lost in the wind, so he shouted it more loudly, drawing the attention of his companion.
"Not long now,"
the man shouted back, voice echoing inside his helm, which glowed blue, most strongly at the edges and across the eye slit.
"I think something might be wrong with my armor," Dalinar shouted to him. "I can't make my helm retract."
In response, the other radiant made his vanish. Dalinar caught sight of a puff of light or mist. Beneath the helm, the man had dark skin and curly black hair. His eyes glowed blue.
"Retract your helm?" he shouted. "You haven't summoned your armor yet. You had to dismiss it so I could lash you."
"Oh," Dalinar thought.
"I mean earlier. It wouldn't vanish when I wanted it to." "Talk to Har-Kalain, then. Or to your Spren."
The Windrunner frowned.
"Will this be a problem for our mission?"
"I don't know,"
Dalinar shouted.
"But it distracted me. Tell me again how we know where to go, and what we know of the things we're going to fight."
He winced at how awkward that sounded.
"Just be ready to back me up against the Midnight Essence and use regrowth on any wounded."
"But..."
"You will find difficulty getting useful answers, Son of Honor," the Stormfather rumbled. "These do not have souls or minds. They are recreations forged by Honor's will, and do not have the memories of the real people."
"Surely we can learn things," Dalinar said under his breath.
"They were created to convey only certain ideas. Further pressing will merely reveal the thinness of the facade."
This brought up memories of the fake city Dalinar had visited in his first vision, the destroyed version of Kolinar that was more prop than reality. but there had to be things he could learn, things that Honor might not have intended but had included by chance. I need to get Navani and Yasna in here, he thought. Let them pick at these recreations. Last time in this vision, Dalinar had taken the place of a man named Heb, a husband and father who had defended his family with only a fireplace poker for a weapon. He remembered his frantic struggle with a beast of oily midnight skin. He had fought, bled, agonized. He'd spent what seemed like an eternity trying, and eventually failing, to protect his wife and daughter. Such a personal memory. False though it was, he had lived it. In fact, seeing the small town ahead, in the late created by a large ridge of rock, made emotions well up inside Dalinar. It was a painful irony that he should have such vivid feelings about this place, these people, when his memories of Evie were still so shadowy and confused. The Windrunner slowed Dalinar by grabbing his arm. They drew to a stop in midair, hovering above the rocky flats outside the village. There! The Windrunner pointed to the field around the town, where weird black creatures were swarming. About the size of an axe hound, they had oily skin that reflected the moonlight. While they moved on all sixes, they were like no natural animal. They had spindly legs like a crab's, but a bulbous body and a sinuous head, featureless except for a slit of a mouth bristling with black teeth. Shallan had faced the source of these things deep within Urethiru. Dalinar had slept a little less secure each night since, knowing that one of the unmade had been hidden in the bowels of the tower. Were the other eight similarly lurking nearby?
I'll go down first, the Windrunner said, and draw their attention. You make for the town and help the people there.
The man pressed his hand against Dalinar.
You'll drop in about 30 seconds.
The man's helm materialized, then he plunged toward the monsters. Dalinar remembered that descent from the vision, like a falling star come to rescue Dalinar and the family.
How? Dalinar whispered to the Stormfather. How do we get the armor?
Speak the words.
Which words?
You will know or you will not.
Great. Dalinar saw no sign of Taffa or Seeley, the family he'd protected, below. In his version, they'd been out here, but their flight had been his doing. He couldn't be sure how the vision had played out this time. Storms. He hadn't planned this very well, had he? In his mind's eye, he'd anticipated getting to Queen Fen and helping her along, making sure she wasn't in too much danger. Instead, he'd wasted time flying here. Stupid. He needed to learn to be more specific with the Stormfather. Dalinar began to descend in a controlled float. He had some idea of how the Windrunner surges worked together, but he was impressed nonetheless. Just as he touched down, the feeling of lightness left him and the stormlight rising from his skin puffed away. This left him as much less of a target in the darkness than the other Radiant, who glowed like a brilliant blue beacon, sweeping about himself with a grand shard blade as he fought the Midnight Essence. Dalinar crept through the town, his common side sword feeling frail compared to a shard blade, but at least it wasn't an iron poker. Some of the creatures scrambled by on the main thoroughfare, but Dalinar hid beside a boulder until they passed. He easily identified the proper house, which had a small barn out back, nestled against the stone cliff that sheltered the town. He crept up and found that the barn wall had been ripped open. He remembered hiding in there with Seeley, then fleeing as a monster attacked. The barn was empty, so he headed for the house, which was much finer. Made of creme bricks and larger, though it seemed only one family lived in it. For a house this big, that would be an oddity, wouldn't it? Space was at a premium in Lates. Some of his assumptions obviously didn't hold in this era. In Alethkar, a fine wooden mansion would be a symbol of wealth. Here, however, many of the other houses were of wood. Dalinar slipped into the house, feeling increasingly worried. Fen's real body couldn't be harmed by what happened in the vision, but she could still feel pain. so while the injuries might not be real, her anger at Dalinar certainly would be. He could ruin any chance of her listening to him.
She's already given up on listening, he assured himself.
Navani agreed. This vision couldn't make things worse. He felt in his uniform's pocket and was pleased to find some gemstones. A radiant would have stormlight. He took out a small diamond, the size of a pebble, and used its white light to inspect the room. The table had been overturned, chairs scattered. The door hung open and creaked softly in a breeze. There was no sign of Queen Fen, but Taffa's body lay face down near the hearth. She wore a single-piece brown dress, now in tatters. Dalinar sighed, sheathing his sword and kneeling to gently touch her back in a spot unraked by monster claws.
It's not real, he told himself. Not now. This woman lived and died thousands of years ago.
It still hurt to see her. He walked to the swinging door and stepped outside into the night, where howls and cries rang out from the town. He strode quickly down the roadway, feeling a sense of urgency. No, not just urgency, impatience. Seeing Taffa's corpse had changed something. He was not a confused man trapped in a nightmare, as he'd feared when first visiting this place. Why was he sneaking? These visions belonged to him. He should not fear their contents. One of the creatures scuttled out of the shadows. Dalinar drew in stormlight as it leaped and bit at his leg. Pain flared up his side, but he ignored it, and the wound re-knit. He glanced down as the creature lunged again, with similar lack of results. It scurried backward a few paces, and he could sense confusion in its posture. This was not how its prey was supposed to act.
You don't eat the corpses, Dalinar said to it. You kill for pleasure, don't you? I often think of how Spren and man are so different, but this we share. We can both murder.
The unholy thing came at him again, and Dalinar seized it in both hands. The body felt springy to the touch, like a wineskin filled to bursting. He painted the writhing monster with stormlight and spun, hurling it toward a nearby building. The creature hit the wall back first and stuck there several feet above the ground, legs scrambling. Dalinar continued on his way. He simply cut through the next two creatures that came for him. Their disjointed bodies twitched, black smoke leaking from the carcasses.
What is that light?
It danced in the night ahead, growing stronger, harsh, orange, flooding the end of the street. He didn't remember a fire from before. Were homes burning? Dalinar approached and found a bonfire, flickering with flame spren, built of furniture. It was surrounded by dozens of people holding brooms and crude picks, men and women alike, armed with whatever they could find. Even an iron poker or two. Judging by the fear spren gathered around them, the townspeople were terrified. They managed some semblance of ranks anyway, with children at the center, nearer the fires, as they frantically defended themselves from the midnight monsters. A figure near the fire commanded from the top of a box. Fen's voice had no accent. To Dalinar, her shouts seemed to be in perfect Alethi, though, in the strange way of these visions, everyone present was actually speaking and thinking in an ancient language.
How did she manage this so quickly? Dalinar wondered, mesmerized by the fighting townsfolk.
Some of them fell in bloody screaming heaps, but others pinned down the monsters and stabbed open their backs, sometimes with kitchen knives, to deflate them. Dalinar remained on the outskirts of the battle until a dramatic figure in glowing blue swept down upon the scene. The Windrunner made short work of the remaining creatures. At the end, he saved a glare for Dalinar.
What are you doing standing there? Why haven't you helped? We'll have words about this when we return, he shouted, pointing toward one of the fallen. Go! Help the wounded!
Dalinar followed the gesture, but walked toward Fen instead of the wounded. Some of the townspeople huddled and wept, though others exulted in survival, cheering and holding up their improvised weapons. He'd seen these after-effects of a battle before. The welling up of emotions came in a variety of ways. The bonfire's heat caused Dalinar's brow to sweat. Smoke churned in the air, reminding him of the place he'd been before he'd fully entered this vision. He'd always loved the warmth of an actual fire, dancing with flame spren, so eager to burn themselves out and die. Ben was over a foot shorter than Dalinar, with an oval face, yellow eyes, and white Thalen eyebrows she kept curled to hang down beside her cheeks. She did not braid her gray hair like an Alethi woman would have, but instead let it fall down to cover her shoulders. The vision had given her a simple shirt and trousers to wear, the costume of the man she'd replaced, though she'd found a glove for her safe hand. "Now the Blackthorn himself shows up," she said. "Damnation, this is a strange dream." "Not quite a dream, Fen," Dalinar said, looking back toward the Radiant, who had charged a small group of midnight monsters coming down the street. "I don't know if I have time to explain." "I can slow it down," one of the villagers said in the Stormfather's voice. "Yes, please," Dalinar said. Everything stopped, or slowed greatly. The bonfire's flames shimmered lethargically, and the people slowed to a crawl. Dalinar was unaffected, as was Fen. He sat down in a box beside the one Fen stood on, and she hesitantly settled down next to him. "A very strange dream. I assumed I was dreaming myself when I saw the first vision," Dalinar said. "When they kept happening, I was forced to acknowledge that no dream is this crisp, this logical. In no dream could we be having this conversation." "In every dream I've experienced, what happened felt natural at the time." "Then you will know the difference when you wake. I can show many more of these visions to you, Fen. They were left for us by a being with some interest in helping us survive the desolations. Best not to get into his heresy at the moment. If one isn't persuasive enough, I understand. I'm dense enough that I didn't trust them for months." "Are they all this invigorating?" Dalinar smiled. "This was the most powerful of them, to me." He looked to her. "You did better than I did. I worried only about Taffa and her daughter, but just ended up getting them surrounded by monsters anyway." "I let the woman die," Fen said softly. "I ran with the child and let the thing kill her. Used her almost as bait." She looked at Dalinar, eyes haunted. "What was your purpose in this, Colin? You imply you have power over these visions. Why did you trap me in this one?" "Honestly, I just wanted to talk to you." "Send me a storming letter." "In person, Fen." He nodded toward the gathered townspeople. "You did this. You organized the town, pitted them against the enemy. It's remarkable. You expect me to accept that you will turn your back on the world in a similar moment of need?" "Don't be dense. My kingdom is suffering. I'm seeing to my people's needs. I'm not turning my back on anyone." Dalinar looked to her and pursed his lips, but said nothing. "Fine," she snapped. "Fine, Colin. You want to dig into it for real? Tell me this. You really expect me to believe that the Storming Knights Radiant are back, and that the Almighty chose you, a tyrant and a murderer, to lead them?" In response, Dalinar stood up and drew in stormlight. His skin began glowing with luminescent smoke drifting from his body. "If you wish proof, I can persuade you. Incredible though it seems, the Radiants have returned." "And the second part? Yes, there is a new storm and perhaps new manifestations of power. Fine. What I don't accept is that you, Dalinar Colin, have been told by the Almighty to lead us."
"I have been commanded to unite."
"A mandate from God. The very same argument the Hierocracy used for seizing control of the government. What about Sadies, the Sunmaker?
He claimed he had a calling from the Almighty, too.
She stood and walked among the people of the town, who stood as if frozen, barely moving. She turned and swept a hand back toward Dalinar.
Now here you are, saying the same things in the same way. Not quite threats, but insistent. Let us join forces. If we don't, the world is doomed.
Dalinar felt his patience slipping. He clenched his jaw, forced himself to be calm, and rose.
Your Majesty, you're being irrational.
Am I? Oh, let me storming reconsider, then. All I need to do is let the storming Blackthorn himself into my city, so he can take control of my armies.
What would you have me do?
Dalinar shouted.
Would you have me watch the world crumble?
She cocked her head at his outburst.
Maybe you're right, and I am a tyrant. Maybe letting my armies into your city is a terrible risk. But maybe you don't have good options. Maybe all the good men are dead, so all you have is me. Spitting into the storm isn't going to change that, Fen. You can risk possibly being conquered by the Alethi, or you can definitely fall to the Voidbringer assault alone.
Curiously, Fen crossed her arms and raised her left hand to her chin, inspecting Dalinar. She didn't seem the least bit fazed by his shouting. Dalinar stepped past a squat man who was slowly, as if through tar, turning toward where they'd once been seated.
Fen, Dalinar said, you don't like me. Fine. You tell me to my face that trusting me is worse than a desolation.
She studied him, aged eyes thoughtful. What was wrong? What had he said?
Fen, he tried again, I...
Where was this passion earlier? She asked. Why didn't you speak like this in your letters to me?
I... Fen, I was being diplomatic.
She sniffed.
That made it sound like I was talking to a committee. It's what one always assumes anyway when communicating via Spanreed.
So?
So compared to that, it's good to hear some honest shouting.
She eyed the people standing around them.
And this is exceptionally creepy. Can we get away from this?
Dalinar found himself nodding, mostly to buy some time to think. Fen seemed to think his anger was a good thing. He gestured at a path through the crowd, and Fen joined him, walking away from the bonfire.
Fen, he said, you say you expected to talk to a committee through the Spanreed. What's wrong with that? Why would you want me to shout at you instead?
I don't want you to shout at me, Colin, she said. But storms, man. Don't you know what has been said about you these last few months?
No.
You've been the hottest topic on the Spanreed informant networks. Dalinar Colin, the Blackthorn, has gone mad. He claims to have killed the Almighty. One day he refuses to fight, then the next day he marches his armies off on an insane quest into the Shattered Plains. He says he's going to enslave the Voidbringers.
I didn't say...
Nobody expects every report to be true, Dalinar. But I had extremely good information claiming you'd lost your mind. Refounding the Knights Radiant? Raving about a desolation? You seized the throne of Alethkar in all but title, but refused to fight the other high princes, and instead ran your armies off into the Weeping. Then you told everyone a new storm was coming. That was enough to convince me that you really were mad.
But then the storm came, Dalinar said.
But then the storm came.
The two walked down the quiet street, light from behind flooding across them, making their shadows lengthen. To their right, a calm blue light shone between buildings, the Radiant, who fought monsters in slowed time. Yasna could probably learn something from these buildings with their old architecture. These people wearing unfamiliar clothing. He'd have expected everything in the past to be crude, but it wasn't. The doors, the buildings, the clothing. It was well made, just lacking something he couldn't define.
The Everstorm proved I wasn't mad,
Dalinar asked.
It proved that something was happening.
Dalinar suddenly stopped.
You think I'm working with them? You think that explains my behavior, my foreknowledge? You think I've been acting erratically because I've been in contact with the Voidbringers?
All I knew, Fenn said, was that the voice on the other end of the span reed was not the Dalinar Kolin I'd expected. The words were too polite, too calm to be trusted.
And now? Dalinar asked.
Fenn turned.
Now, I'll consider. Can I see the rest of it? I want to know what happens to the little girl.
Dalinar followed her gaze and saw, for the first time, little Seeley sitting, huddled with some other children near the fire. She had a haunted cast to her eyes. He could imagine her horror as Fenn ran away, Taffa, the child's mother, screaming as she was ripped apart. Seeley suddenly lurched into motion, turning her head to stare with a hollow gaze at a woman who knelt beside her, offering something to drink. The Stormfather had restored the vision's normal speed. Dalinar backed up, letting Fenn rejoin the people and experience the end of the vision. As he folded his arms to watch, he noted a shimmering in the air beside him.
"We'll want to send her more of these," Dalinar said to the Stormfather. "We can only be served by more people knowing the truths the Almighty left behind. Can you bring in only one person per storm, or can we accelerate that somehow? And can you bring two people into two different visions at once?"
The Stormfather rumbled.
"I do not like to be ordered about."
"And you prefer the alternative? Letting Odium win? How far will your pride push you, Stormfather?"
"It is not pride," the Stormfather said, sounding stubborn. "I am not a man. I do not bend or cower. I do what is in my nature, and to defy that is pain."
The Radiant finished off the last of the midnight creatures and stepped up to the gathered people, then looked at Fenn.
"Your upbringing might be humble, but your talent for leadership is impressive. I have rarely seen a man, king or commander, organize people for defense as well as you did here today."
Fenn cocked her head.